Hey, welcome to Beyond the Norm. I'm Norm Lavalette. I'm the host of this show. As always, this is where we talk about comedy and improv and the entertainment business and entrepreneurship and really anything that we like. Joined with me, as always, is the lovely, the talented, the effervescent Ari Goldberg. Say hello, Ari.
Hey, how's it going? Effervescent. It was mysterious in the last episode. Now I'm bubbly.
Yeah, is that what effervescent means?
Yeah, bubbly.
Yeah, oh, that's good. I was just asking. It's one of those words where you kind of know what it means, but you also don't. I think you're bubbly.
Well, thanks. I like to think I am too. Well, hey, I've got a big update.
Please.
I have opened the window that I discovered in the last episode, and my bedroom is 100 times brighter.
Well, this is amazing news. So for anybody that maybe didn't listen to the last episode, we found that in Ari's room there was a hidden window that Ari, in all his time living in his room, never knew was there.
Yeah, and it had been open for God knows how long, and I finally figured it out, and now my room feels a lot homier. That's where I'm at.
See, Ari, we can have adventures close to home. We don't have to travel internationally, right? If you just explore your own backyard, you never know what you're going to find. So that's very good. Well, I'm glad you have that. Things have not changed too much for me. We're just down here in the Ducks, Duxbury, quarantining as always. And whenever we start the show, oftentimes I like to go over the three basic metrics that I used in helping me make decisions. They're not set in stone, certainly, but I use them a little bit. One, for me to decide to move forward with something is, does it make me money? Do I love it? Or am I intellectually curious about it? If it ticks any one of those three boxes, it's something that I'm usually worth. It's usually worth my time to explore. So in the making money front, still not a lot going on. Businesses are not yet open. Not sure when they're going to be. But with that said, even though they're not open, the companies, all three of them, Improv Asylum in Boston, Improv Asylum in New York, Laugh Boston, are in good stead, and we fully expect all of them to open when each government and state allows us to do so. But what has been interesting is, it's always been the function of my job, but it still continues on, is we're already talking, we're putting in proposals, we're making plans in terms of long-range shows for the fall. So, it's not making any money yet, but on the other hand, all the companies will be coming back. And so it's at least been nice to be doing more and more meetings, talking about what some things are coming up, what some shows, what some potential bigger deals might be coming along the line. If that they do happen, they will be noteworthy. So that's coming along. As far as love goes, it's really germane to today, this is a classic spring day in New England. It's 40 degrees with pelting, freezing rain. And it just makes me want to nap. And I love napping, Ari. That is one thing I love to do. And in this weather, it's really nice. So like when it's pelting, pouring rain, what I like to do is I like to bundle up on my hammock on my porch, and I bundle up. Mm-hmm. And because it's pouring rain, I like to pretend I'm on the deck of a ship. So that's what you do when you're in quarantine. You pretend that you're in a deck of a ship. So I have that. And then intellectual curiosity, still coming off of a marathon watching of Moonshiners. I'm really getting intrigued by the idea of distilling. Oh, and watching these guys make White Lightning and Moonshine. And there is a difference, which I did not know. White Lightning. And moonshine. So moonshine, if you're doing it correctly, if you're doing it in the authentic artisanal way, is that you're distilling at night by moonshine. If you're distilling during the day, that's White Lightning.
And does that produce a different like flavor profile?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Is there a difference?
But
okay.
Yeah. One has moonlight and one has sunlight, Ari. That's the difference.
All right. Okay.
I'm learning. I'm learning. So that's been my intellectual curiosity. As always, I'm so lucky on this show because of my relationships in the entertainment industry for the past 20 some odd years. I just know and get to talk and have had relationships with so many great people. I can honestly say that this next guest is probably the funniest person that has ever graced the stage at Improv Asylum. I can't think of anybody up and down the line that has ever been funnier and more talented on stage. But beyond that, I also have a very long history with this person. She really, truly is probably somebody that I hold up in the highest regard personally and professionally. I've known her, and we'll talk about this when we get on, but since she was 17, she was a former main stage actor at Improv Asylum. She is now an amazing performer at the Second City. She's performed at Second City, certainly in their touring companies. She's performed all over the world on their cruise ships. She has worked with Improv Asylum directing shows on our main stage. She's taught. She's an instructor. She's really just probably one of the best people in comedy that I've ever had the privilege to know, and I'm thrilled to have her here. From Chicago, say hello, Kylie Fitzgerald.
Oh, hi, Norm. That you got me all choked up. Oh man, that's so sweet. Thank you.
I don't mean to choke you. They don't mean to choke you up. But it's all absolutely true. I mean, again, we all know people because we haven't quit or died in this business yet. And yet, I, you know, our relationship certainly goes back a very, very long, long way. So, am I right to say you were 17? How old were you when you started?
No, I was, but I wasn't far from that. I was, I was 20 and I turned 21 the following week or 2 weeks later.
I knew you were young. I knew you were, I think 17, that was Chris Carpenter. I think he was the youngest one.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. And so you started, yeah, Chris Carpenter, God bless. So I think people love to hear the stories because, you know, what we talk about on the show a lot is more, you know, less the, not that we don't discuss the creative side of things, but the business aspect of it or the professional side of it. And people, I think, are just intrigued by everybody's journey because, you know, they always want to know what, how. So yours is great. So you started as an usher, right?
I did. I started taking classes and I, you know, the real story, I went and saw Kids in the Hall. And mm-hmm. The night I went and saw them, I somehow got backstage and met them and was like, okay, well, I was there. It was honestly probably like the first time I'd ever smoked weed in my life. So I wasn't really high at all, but I was like pretending like I was.
Sure.
Yeah. And I was with the friends that I had before I started doing improv. So who knows? And, I would think I worked with them at a Chili's and we went and one friend of mine, this girl, Kara, who I do remember quite well, she's a wonderful person. She bought her tickets that day. And you know, when you buy tickets that day, you sit right up front because right. They have to fill those space. And she talked to one of their, like their road manager or something. Cause she's really, really, really cute. And she was like, so can we get backstage? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. And so I was in the group that she brought backstage. And you know, if you remember me back as a kid and you remember me now, just like a dopey tomboy with pink hair. So I wasn't going back there for the action. And I was going back there for the nerd time and the free fruit. And
sorry.
No, it's true. Like, I think when she said, I have friends, can I bring them back too? I think the guy was like, hell yeah, we're going to get it done tonight. And then I walked backstage in raver pants and a ringer t-shirt that had a little cardinal playing hockey on it. I was like, hi, I love you guys. I know every episode you've ever done. And I was so shocked that I met them and that this was a group that I had loved since I was, I don't know, 9 or 10. I started seeing them and I was so shocked that I had just thought to myself, wow, all that time I love them, and here they are right here. I bet I could do what they're doing, because if I can meet them, I could probably be them. And
sound logic.
It's, I mean, it's sound logic when you're a 20-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. I've met two of the Beatles, so I should be able to be a Beatle. Why not?
And you could. I mean, you honestly could. You honestly could. All you need is a haircut and a long general's jacket. And so that night I went home and I started, it was Ask Jeeves, and I was like, what's improv? And I learned what improv was that night. And the very next day I was working a shift at Chili's, and I saw in the newspaper there was the article about Gary's Pocket, which was the very first graduating class at Improv Asylum. And I called up, and I remember I called my mom and I was like, can I have $200 for a class? And she was like, sure. And I mean, she would never give me money for anything. And she gave me money for that. And I called up, and so also
to stop you there too, is just for people that are listening, and you did it a little bit, but I want to hear more, is where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dorchester, Massachusetts.
And my mother and no father, but a brother
who was a dad to me. So, you know, dirt poor, no matter what a former piano player at Improv Asylum used to say. Absolutely dirt poor, like lived in the projects, thought government cheese was a treat. An expensive treat, and we never had toothpaste with a label on it because we also got government toothpaste. But she gave me the money, and I called up, signed up for class. I got the last spot in my class, and that ended up being a class that had all of the people that worked at Improv Asylum at the time, basically all like the support staff, like music and tech. And that was the day Stacy had asked if anybody wanted to work there at the end of the class. And I was like, I do, me. Can I work here? And like 4 days later, that was a Saturday, like probably Thursday, I came in, and that's when I met Chris Carpenter. And and I except for a short time, I never left. So
sure. Well, and it was great too, because, you know, Kylie and we've known each other a long time, and it's, I have the privilege to watching and knowing so many people truly grow up and change and go from, you know, that little punk with, you know, her pants pegged up and, you know, hair dyed a different color every other day to just this accomplished and amazing and elegant woman that, you know, really just controls the world in terms of how you move through it. So it was pretty fun. And so, you know, Kylie, but you started, right? You were an usher. You were mopping the urine in the bathrooms and cleaning up the vomit.
100%. Yeah. I was an usher, but if you remember, I was only an usher for a really, really short time, probably like 2 months or so. And I don't know if I'm sure you do remember, you have a good memory like I do, sitting under the booth, we were watching the show, and it was during the show, you were in it, and you said, would you rather be backstage? And I was like, yes. And you were like, all right, how about tomorrow you come in, you'll be our stage manager. And you were basically like, we don't have anything for you to do, but I just need you to figure out a way to get paid. And I was like, okay. And that was like the start of it. I just finished saying to my husband, that was the moment I really, really started, I think, was that moment.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's no one way to come at this work, and everybody comes at it at their own time, at their own pace. But even in those earliest of early days with you, I mean, you always had that amazing spark, and you can't teach the spark. You can teach everything else, but you can't teach the spark. It either develops or it doesn't. And sometimes it develops in people far later. People that you would never even think would get it, they do. But you always had that. You had that in the very beginning. But it was no. But even though, you know, personally caring very much for you, it was no easy journey. Not even at the asylum, right? So talk a little bit about, you know, getting into the touring companies at the time or whatever. What was your path there? We went away, and then our very famous dinner when you came back.
It wasn't easy, and I'll say I also, you know, credit you and Chet with not making it easy for me, because, you know, it's best to learn how to deal with disappointment when you're a kid rather than, you know, having an outburst at 34 years old. And but I think so by the time my grad class had finished, we were called Honorable Discharge.
That's right. Honorable Discharge. I remember you guys. Yeah.
God, and I remember one guy wanted, now this, I don't know what rating you're.
You can say whatever the hell you want. It doesn't make any difference.
But one guy in our class wrote a parody to Barry Manilow's Daybreak, and it was called Date Rape. You know how I am and my taste level and what I think is acceptable. I was like, honestly, that sounds great. Let's do it. This is pre-9/11 world, so...
It was a pre-9/11 world, and Kylie has been one of the most fearless performers that I've ever met. And even at a young age, Kylie's like, "Great, I'll lean into that." She takes something that is suspect, and she makes it joyful for everybody.
Yeah, that's fun. Well, that's what I try to do. I think that if like you like something, and you're like, I think I know where this is coming from, and then you trust it, and you just say like, "Well, let's see," but. I remember being fully on board with that Date Rape parody, and this is the first time I've ever admitted it. So, but before I graduated from that grad class, I was on the touring company, right. And it was not easy. I didn't think I was going to make it. I had only been doing improv for like 3 months at the time when I made it. And I remember the walk down the hallway with you and Chet and mm-hmm. into an office that nobody really, I feel like nobody really ever used it at the time. By the back entry, it's like just like a murder hallway. And I remember walking back there and we always joke about the Emperor's March from Star Wars is the sound dun, you hear.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I get back there and I remember you guys were being like real sort of stoic about it. And then you were like, so, unfortunately, we want to ask you if you want to be on the touring company. And I was like, I get it. I'm sorry. Oh, what? And I remember you flipped it and I joined the touring company with a couple of older gals, who I had a hard time working with, and
there was the chemistry was, you know, when you're creating something new and the company was new at the time, trying to figure out everybody's chemistry, it probably, you know, probably lacked a certain amount of chemistry, but you know, we're all trying.
We really lacked the chemistry. I think that is hitting the nail on the head with that one. Some of my worst moments of ever performing were in those moments, and. But also some of my most favorite memories are from that time. Like I was on a cast with Harry and sure. Travis Thomas, and a Brian Polak, like a Tim, and like just a bunch of people and all these great people who became such big parts of my life. But the touring company was on shaky grounds at that
time. Well, it was. And it was because look, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, what was this, 2000, 2001?
It was 2000, you know? 2001. It was even already 2001, but it was like February or something.
Right. And so when you look at that, like, you know, and it's crazy to think about it, but like the company had been around for barely 3 years. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't know what the hell. I didn't know what I was doing. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. We were evolving and trying, and the company was new. The work as even a commercial product was brand new, right? The world barely knew what it was, and yet that's how we all start, right? You figure it out, and you know you just try to make it better. But yeah, I mean, that company, yeah. You know, that touring company was new, and the company itself was, you know, was. Fledgling.
I mean, it was all made. Everything was made up, right? Like, nope, there was no guideline to what we were supposed to do. And but at the time when I joined, that was the very, very beginning of it really catching on. Like, right. And so growth was happening, and I think it was more growth in a really small amount of time that I don't think anybody could have ever predicted. But all of a sudden, it was like everybody was going to Improv Asylum Friday and Saturday night. It was jam packed.
Yeah, as successful as the place got, there was no, it had nothing to do with us in terms of our genius. It was really stunning in a lot of ways. It was like, holy shit. I mean, obviously we were doing at the time, you know, good work, but I think it was more to the point, it was work nobody had ever seen. And, you know, it went from like, you know, people paying each other in beer to like you said, the place just being packed. It was crazy.
It was truly insane. It was insane. I can remember the first time we went into the round and it was like, we have to have room for like 100 more people down here. Yeah. And it was like, what is happening? But because of that growth, I think that things for the touring company, which was that. We're just like the bad news bears of the building, just a ragtag bunch of people whose stomachs stuck out of their shirts, covered in stains. All of us smelled like cigarettes. I just feel like because of that, we were all like, what's going to happen to us, Norm? And I mean, it was like, well, you know, there were the lambs, so we're like the first to go, I think.
Well, and not only that, but like, you know, because it was quote unquote still that you know, that first generation of you know, the original casts, and the place operated completely different back then than it did now. I mean, a main stage cast had 11 or 12 actors in it. I mean, it was just a totally different beast. But
everybody had a goatee.
Everybody had a goatee. It was really fantastic. Eddie Mejia always wore a Georgia Bulldogs logoed polo shirt.
And those pants.
And those pants that showed a lot in the crotch.
Yes.
So, you know, they were different times. But we didn't even know what it meant or how it meant for performers to leave and new performers to be hired. I mean, you know, you look at it now, 22 years in, it's a machine, right? And there's a very, there's mm-hmm. a system, but there wasn't, we don't, you know, it, like you said, we had no roadmap. We had no guidance. We were just figuring it out. And so, you know, as great as it was on one level, it was very difficult for, I think, especially newer people trying to navigate their way in.
Yeah, there was never ever a feeling like, oh, this is permanent. But like, we were told from day one, and I know you know this phrase, that it's a numbers game.
It is a numbers game.
Which is, and I feel like what you have tattooed on your face.
It is. It's there, but it's in Chinese characters, but it says it's a numbers game. It's pretty great. But to be fair, because I'm always misquoted on that, which is everybody leaves it at that as if I'm talking about monetary numbers, and I'm not talking about monetary numbers.
No,
you know. It was always talking about there's only, and it's true to this day, of course, there are only mm-hmm. so many slots and there are always far more people vying for them. That's all it is.
But putting it like it's a numbers game, I know for sure I understood what you meant. I it's like, yeah, you got to shuffle these people around. They can't all be the same. They can't all have the same point of view. Now I, of course, understand it. And it's like the easiest way to take it if you get let go. At this point, it's like, well, it's a numbers game. What are you going to do?
Sure.
That's just life. It's just life. So, you know, it's not that you, is. It's a number.
And so we had that. And then how it blurs in my mind. Were you around when we did when the main stage moved for a brief time over to the Roxy?
Yes, and that was crazy because the touring company, this group of people who hadn't been even performing for a year, was now performing to the sold out shows on Friday and Saturday night in the North End. So I think it was probably like 6 or 7 months into my comedy career, and I was performing for like 1,000 people a weekend.
Yeah.
At 21 years old. Like it's nuts.
And it was one of those situations too, where, and so that we had the opportunity, and again, we don't know what we're doing. So like, all right, we'll give it a try. And we had the offer to do Fridays and Saturday nights at the Roxy, which was like a 500 to 700 seat room. And to show you how crazy the numbers were, Kylie, we were selling out the shows in the North End. And I know that the Roxy was a horrible disaster, but the numbers were there because like four or 500 people were showing up for those shows. And so you had the North End, you had the Roxy, except the difference with the Roxy was it was very impersonal, and the floor was completely just sticky from the Chippendales dancers that would always go on before us.
It was so sticky. It was so sticky because it was Chippendales right before you guys or like whatever that group of male exotic dancers were. There was always
I say Chippendales.
Underwear.
I don't know who it was. Oh, it was underwear. And in the dressing room, in the green room, we would show up and there would be 2 liter, soda bottles, right? 2 liter soda bottles filled with urine. I don't know why these guys.
They can't go out because those women will rip them apart.
But how much do you have to go in like an hour or an hour and a half show?
Well, they're fit dancers. They drink a lot. They chug that water, and they're probably drunk. You got to be drunk to
drunk and high and everything else. And
there was a matinee showing of Chippendales in the theater district of Boston.
Yeah, there was these giant 2 liter bottles of urine and just like hundreds of like tissues all over the dressing room.
That goes without saying. We know what happens there.
Yeah, it was a good time. So we decided that artistically and business wise, maybe being over at the Roxy wasn't the right place for us. To which we had to break the news to the touring company that the main stage was, hey, I hope you enjoyed the sublet of our apartment, but we're coming back in.
And I remember every week we knew that the shows were doing really well at the Roxy, but we knew that nobody liked performing there.
Oh, so painful.
Amongst the sticky floors, the tissues and the underpants and piss. And I remember on like Thursdays, cause I was still doing stage manager stuff. The cast would be so upset about having to leave and go to the Roxy the next day. And I would be silent, like, yeah, too bad. See you guys later. Cause I got sold out shows for the next 2 days.
Right. In this warm cocoon of a theater that is like literally designed for the type of work that we do.
Oh, no better theater for improv on the planet. No better theater. And we had to do a big old reshuffle, and that's where things took a turn for the worse.
Sure. And this goes back to, I think, what you were saying earlier, and certainly, you were young and all that, but, and this is true to this day, I said it then, and I say it to any performer that's at the asylum now, is no matter how much we like you or care about you, what you can always know at the asylum is what you get there is because you earned it. You'll never be given anything because we liked you or because you did this or because you did that. And so when we had to do the reshuffle, well, we couldn't hold on to all of those performers. And unfortunately, you being one of the younger people, even though you were incredibly funny, we felt like you didn't have quite as much experience as some of the other people that we were looking at. And you were caught up in the cut, if I remember correctly.
I sure was. I was one of the culled animals at the zoo. And at the time, I was working at my parents' liquor store in Fields Corner in Dorchester, place where they'd be like, don't worry, if someone comes in to rob you, there's a bat behind the counter. And I'm like, cool, okay. And you had to call me there because this was also kind of pre-cell phone. And I remember you called me and it was on a payphone because there was only a payphone at the liquor store. And you called me and you broke the news.
I don't think I know that that was on a payphone. I don't think I knew that's part of the story.
Yeah, it's absolutely on a payphone where like there were like three or four other people standing there because they used it as there's a rooming house next door. And the guys from the rooming house used to use that phone as their own. And so when I went over there and the phone rang, they were all like scrambling to get the phone. And I'm like, calm down, this is for me. And they're like, all right, but hurry up. I got phone calls that I'm waiting for. And we talked, you and I, and I remember I was not nice to you. You were very nice to me and I wasn't nice to you. And I remember, I just said to Steven, my husband, I was like, I definitely like screamed at Norm, swore at Norm, said all this stuff. And I was like, I know that after when he got off the phone, he was probably sitting there with Chet and hung up the phone. He probably had like that face you get where it's like kind of a smile, but not really, but was like, yeah, she acted exactly how she should have reacted. Like she cares about this and she's fucking pissed. And yeah. Like,
absolutely. That's exactly how I was. And yeah. You know, when you're in a position and now you understand it because you're a director, you're somebody that, you know, does take on these kind of decisions and authority roles. You understand that you're, especially in this business, you're going to disappoint a ton of people. You're going to tell a lot of people that they can't have at this moment the thing that they want. And you know, for me, I've never taken it personally, and especially you know this from the asylum in particular, it tends to be almost everybody's first job professionally speaking, right? It's almost everybody's first, you know, dip in the water. And I don't take it personally because I'm like, yeah, that's exactly how she should respond. She cares not only about the work, but she's a young person that has all these relationships. And I think people are usually at least equally as upset, not only the not having the opportunity anymore to do the work, but what does it mean for all those personal relationships too? You know, and so all those things come together and I, you know, hey, look, you swear a little bit at me and call me an asshole. You're not wrong. I mean, what am I going to lie? You know, like,
I think in the moment, I remember you, cause I was, you know me, I'm explosive and I fight. And I said something to you and I don't remember what I said, but then you were like, hey, look, stop it. Now you're starting to burn some bridges here. And I went, I'm not burning bridges. You burned a bridge. And I remember, and you were like, all right, oh, okay. Well, I will talk to you later. And I was like, yeah. And I remember like you letting me have that moment was kind of like, and not like, taking it personal and saying anything bad about me to me. That was kind of the thing that drove me to, because, you know, what did I have? I didn't go to college. I didn't have a theater background or anything like that. All I had was the Improv Asylum. And you letting me have that moment, I think, was what kept me going for like the next 2.5 years of being like, I'll show Norm.
well, the thing about it, right, was there's no doubt how good and how talented that you were and that you want to do this. And you know, I maintain that I'm, you know, you're just trying to make the decisions that you think are best at the time. And sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. But at that time, it was right for the theater. And it was really probably right for you, too, because you then were able to prove to yourself that you didn't need the asylum to do comedy. You didn't need the asylum and the relationships like maybe you probably thought you did. You went on and you did so much more. And so you went on. And what were the shows that you were in? The one down at the – was it the Cantab?
I mean that – you letting me go, I know now, like – if you didn't let me go, I don't think that I would still be a part of it, because I experienced like the pain and loss of getting fired from something you love so much. And the whole feeling of being like, I'll show them, which is, you know, the fire that you need when you're that age to keep going. But I remember now, I know for a fact that had that not happened, I don't think I would have kept going. And I knew that you guys knew I was going to do something else. And I don't know if everybody else, the people that you kept, I don't know if everybody there would have been able to do it, because I, you know, not to say anything bad about them, but I think they were a little more fragile than I was. I had ego, but I wasn't fragile. Like, I came from such a bad place that I was like, this is nothing. I'll show him.
Well, you have the fighter's mentality. I mean, look, the way you grew up and coming from, you know, Dorchester, and everything was a fight. Everything was a struggle. And I think for what you didn't have, and I think, you know, we oftentimes feel like we're inadequate because we didn't go to college, or we didn't graduate from college, or we didn't study in a renowned theater program or an improv program and stuff like that. We're really, none of that matters, because you had something that was way, way more significant in terms of what you could do, which is the fire to fight and drive on regardless. And that's more important than any kind of training that you can get. And you had that.
Yeah. And I never would have known that had I not been let go that day. I never would have known that. Immediately after I got off the phone with you, a small Asian woman turned to me. I was wearing a vest, like a fleece vest. And she turned to me and she goes, "Are you pregnant?" And I remember being like, I've got to show the world, apparently, that I'm better than this. And I was like, go buy your alcohol, you jerk.
Are you pregnant?
I was like, no, I've been fat since I was 8. Leave me a be.
I think she might have more been reacting to you screaming at the baby daddy who is denying staying with you. I like to think that she was more referencing what she heard.
She poked at my vest.
Okay, well then, yeah, all right, that's what she was going for then.
Oh, she was calling me fat, 100%. And I remember being like, I can't be, because now I'm not an actor at Improv Asylum, I'm not a comedian at Improv Asylum, I'm just a fat girl in a vest, and I can't just be that. I can't be a fat girl in a vest who works at a liquor store in the middle of the worst part of the bad neighborhood in Boston. I can't be that person. So I immediately found something else. And I went to the Cantab and I started doing show. Well, I started doing stuff with the Tribe, which doesn't exist
the
anymore.
Tribe, that's right. They were a hot comet shooting across the landscape of Boston for about 18 months.
18 months. But I'll tell you what, it was wild. And
it was.
The thing was is that they truly, it was Neeraj Tulley, Michelle Barbera.
Yep.
They really respected the work I had already done, and they let me do whatever I wanted to do. And I did some of the craziest things in those shows. Like I did a show called First Kiss, where we would have somebody do a monologue, and then my ex-husband and I, he wasn't my ex-husband at the time. He was just a future mistake waiting to happen. He and I would then act out the person's first kiss, because we were in a unique situation where we were improvisers who it wouldn't be weird if we did kiss on stage, because for every other improvisers, it'd be like, this is disgusting and I can't do this. Like, I can't.
Sure.
It's too uncomfortable. You can't get that close to people you have to be close with all the time. And
great premise for a show, by the way.
It was fantastic. We had such a great time. That's where I met Brian O'Hara, who he was like 19 at the time and coming from Southie. And just, I saw myself in him so much and just sort of glommed onto him. And we did crazy stuff at that show, and that lasted for about 2 years. And that's where I was like, oh, I can do this. And I don't need anything but like the slightest little hint of an idea, and I can go on stage and I can just talk about anything for as long as I need to. I met Richie Moriarty there.
Yep.
And he was in a show called Spinning Hardcore, and that's all I really remember about it. Yeah, I met everybody. I met a lot of people there, and that was also in the theater district in Boston, and it was at a club that at 9:30 this place would go from like a secret little den where schlubby nerds hung out and did superhero shows to a place that they would put up a fresh batch of posters all over in the bathrooms and stuff that said, "No bareback in our club."
Classy just, joints.
Just a picture of two guys going at it. And it said, "No bareback." And it said, like, "Use a condom."
Well, and the thing about it, and I think this is, and it'll sound crazy, but those places don't really exist too much in Boston anymore. I don't know how it is in Chicago. They don't. And it's really, really too bad because those were the places that toughened you up and taught you how to be a performer, not an improviser or anything like that, but a performer. And you know, sometimes I feel like the same thing that makes places like Second City or Improvisado or UCB successful are the same things that kind of soften everybody up. And you want to tell people, especially people coming up, I'm like, hey, I didn't come up in these lovely theaters where everybody was just there to support you. You know, when you're doing shows that turn into a club that say no bareback in our bathrooms, it's a different animal than, you know, complaining because it's too hot at the theater downstairs.
Exactly. Like, while we were doing shows at the Tribe, there were definitely people who would come in, like club crowd people that would come in early, and you just see like these angry guys with like boners standing in the front, like, you know, cocaine on their faces and scratches and stuff like that. You're like, oh, this guy's not here for comedy. This guy's looking to do some barebacking right now. So,
oh, man.
I mean, yeah, it was not easy. And the biggest difference that I realized is that at Improv Asylum, the shows, the people just showed up. And at the Tribe, they had to advertise. We had to like ask people to come to our shows. And we did a variety show for a while where the prize was something like 10,000 pennies or something. It was like $100. And this variety show, I mean, we just did things like one time I did an act where I taped a blow up doll to my body and danced to Lover's Holiday by Chicago, and but crazy things would happen at this variety show. But one day, a real little girl who was 13 years old, her mother brought her there to do the talent show, and she thought it was real. And she got up on, we thought it was a joke. She got up on stage and sang Black Velvet. Meanwhile, I'm waiting on the sideline dressed like Batman to do a karaoke version of Kiss from a Rose dressed like Batman. And she got up there and she sang and she was like, "I really hope I win." She had been traveling all over the Northeast doing these variety shows.
Oh my God.
We were like, we got to give this girl the prize. And we gave her a bag of pennies.
And that girl was Scarlett Johansson.
That was can play anybody in anything, Scarlett Johansson. Yes.
Changed her life. Oh God, that reminds me. Were you at the I think it was at a No Rest, but that just reminds me of, do you remember little Freddie Mercury, the kid that came out and just did Freddie Mercury? Do you remember that at all?
It's the highlight of everybody's life. It's the highlight. Oh, he didn't want to be there. Do you remember that? He didn't want to do it. And his parents made him dress up like Freddie Mercury in little shorts and a little white tank top and a little mustache. And he Swiffered the floor to Another One Bites the Dust.
Yeah.
He Swiffered.
Yeah.
Child abuse at its best.
Crazy. So then that kind of takes us to the evolution where we had a roast, we had a roast at the Midnight Show for Harry Gordon, right? Fast forwarding to that. And, you know, I think that at that point, our relationship was cordial, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, there was still some coldness or distance between you and your relationship with the asylum, but you were very close to Harry, who is one of the funniest human beings to, you know, grace any stage anywhere.
Yeah.
And so Harry really wanted to have a roast for himself. I think he was leaving the main stage or something like that. And so a lot of people were invited. There was obviously current main stage people, and you were invited as well. Right. So take us through that.
Okay. So I had not been to Improv Asylum at this point in 3 years, and it was I think our relationship was fine. Like, we had both been like you were always fine with me. I mean, you let me have my angry time, and then at this point it was sort of like there is no, we're just sort of like, oh, how you doing? And I was invited, and I was like, I don't want to go, but I knew that I had to. I knew that I had to do it for Harry, and because Harry is just so beloved by everybody who knows him. And we went out to dinner first, and that is where I truly first met Richie, and we became best friends at a dinner table. And then we were going across the street to go and do Harry's roast, and I remember seeing you and seeing Chet, and like, I think you guys were both as nervous as I was to see each other, because who knows, you know, I could blow up. Like, I knew you guys weren't going to blow up, but I was like, am I going to blow up? Am I going to be an asshole? Like, what's going to happen? And I wasn't. I was calm and collected, but I remember the moment of making the lineup, and nobody wanted to go first, and so I was like, I'll go first. And I remember you and Chet looking at me and going, really? And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And that was like, I feel like that was part of the whole magic of that moment. Nobody wanted to go first, and so I was like, I'll go first. And I think that that was the moment, Norm, when you and Chet knew, like, okay, something's going on here. Like, she's going first. The person who hasn't been in this building in 3 years is going to go first. And it kind of, like, in that moment, you both kind of gave me this look of like, wow, respect. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when you went first, I mean, we, you know, you brought the house down. You were super funny, but we both understood, you know, it's two and a half, 3 years had passed. 3 years of, you know, we all know that from being 21 to being 24, 25, that's different, right? I mean, it just is. And 3 years as a performer, yeah. But not only that, you had the bravery of going first, but you also brought the house down in a very funny and powerful way.
It was just like it was a really good moment. There's so many people in that room that I loved and hadn't seen in a long time. And just thought, I mean, some of the things that were said that night, obviously we cannot ever repeat.
I
remember in particular, it was horrific. I remember in particular some of the things that Mike said and Mike Anastasia, and still to this day is some of my most favorite offensive jokes I've ever heard. But I went first, and I played an old fat woman that was in love with Harry, and that I was the kind of woman that Harry wanted to date, because we used to make fun of him that he only liked to date women his age. At the time, Harry was like 40 or 41 or something, which I'm older than that now, but we used to make fun of him that he only liked old women and that he only liked really, really big women. And nothing wrong with that, but it was just, Harry was very into that, and he still, I'm sure he probably still is. And so that's what I was playing, because I'm not small. And I remember getting up there and being like, well, I'm just going to be this old Russian woman who's hot for Harry. And it went over well. And I thought it was so fun. And then a couple of people off main stage, they were late.
And you're being generous there. So within the folklore of that era of the asylum, while some people came out from maybe, you know, out in the woods and brought the house down, there was maybe some people or a person that was currently on the main stage that didn't do quite so well. Maybe wasn't accessing all that they could. And so some changes had to be made, and it wasn't because of that roast by any stretch of the imagination. But as we know, it is a business. And so I had to make some changes. So one of the main stage actors was not retained. And that's when I called you up and I said, hey, you know, would you be up for having meeting me for dinner at where did we go? Mother Anna's?
We went to Mother Anna's, yeah. Mother Anna's has the best, flattest chicken parmesan in the world. that roast was really great for what it was for, but there was also for sure a respect level that was going on that night for various reasons that don't obviously need to be brought up, but there was a level of respect that was being observed by everybody, except for a couple of people. And in that moment, I remember being like, you know, 5 years ago, I would have been just like them right now. But you know, you grow up when you have to go out on your own. And that next day later that week when we went out to dinner, I remember being like, I don't know. I honestly don't know what's about, like, why we're going out. Like, I don't know if he wants to ask me to come back. I really wasn't sure. I thought maybe you would be like, would you be interested in teaching, or do you want to understudy for a while and then come back? But it was just like a flat out, do you want to come back? And that surprised me. That was
When you look at the talent, when you look at the work, and you were one of the funniest and most talented people working in Boston, and my personal opinion of you had never changed, and it really had only grown in terms of your own work, and I think whatever the estrangement might have been between us or the asylum and you, I think we all knew. I'm like, but she still bleeds asylum. Like I think deep down in there she does. And the offer was, as I said before, was made for no other reason than we thought that you would be an amazing addition to the main stage cast. And so, I'm gonna pussyfoot around there, Kylie. I'm like, you want to come back?
And I remember I said, can I think about it? Because that's what you're supposed to do when someone asks you something. You're supposed to be like, let me show you that I'm an adult now, instead of being like, yes, can I be in the show tonight? Because you know that's what my thoughts were. Let me be in the show tonight. But I was like, let me think about it. And you looked at me like, all right, asshole, I'll let you think about it. Call me by 4 o'clock tomorrow. And at 4 o'clock, I called you the next day. And you were like, yeah, good. See you Thursday for rehearsal. And I was like, cool.
And the rest was history. And honestly, it was one of the best casting opportunities the asylum has ever had in terms of you coming back. Your level of voice and comedy and assuredness and no holds barred and not giving a shit about what other people think, I think made you beloved by the audiences, by your cast. And I think to this day, the confidence and the bravery that you always showed on that stage taught a lot of people, because, you know, as we know, there are a lot of people can be technically good improvisers. A lot of people can be technically good improv and sketch comedy performers. But oftentimes they lack that comedy presence. And a lot of it is because they're fearful or they're afraid of going too far. And I think that by watching you on stage, you brought out the best in your cast members, because quite frankly, they had to step up to keep up. And it was really fun to watch.
I mean, that cast became my family. Like, the people that were on that cast became my absolute family. It was Taylor and Jeremy and Mike and Brian and probably like Richie was. Richie really became like a brother to me, and still very much is like that. I mean, they all are. I love them all the same. But it changed my life. It changed everything about my life. And I think you were not our first director, but you came in to direct after some shuffling about. And I remember that was where I was like, this is the best. And we sang a song about mustache rides to close out the show. And I remember being like, this is what I was born to do. And the song started with us singing a fake parody of We Built This City on Rock and Roll to a song about making fun of Jessica Simpson and how and her weight, because it was all that the tabloids were talking about at the time. And Richie like fake interrupts us at the beginning of this song. It was a terrible song. I remember all the words, but I'm not going to sing it. But and I remember it ends with me singing about mustache rides.
Yeah.
And having to sing that in front of my mom. And my mom was like, I like that mustache rides line you put in there. I'm like, you would. You absolutely would.
It was great stuff. And, you know, and it was really wonderful to have you there. And this also goes back to, and I think for people that are listening, and yet, right, and yet within all that time and having you come back, you know, none of us are doing this in a vacuum, and we're living our lives in the ups and the downs. And, you know, and you certainly experienced that in a very real sense in your personal life.
Yes. Yeah. I got divorced. I was married to somebody who at the beginning was not on a cast there, but then was on a cast there. And, my ex-husband started dating, he was my husband at the time, started dating a woman who was on a cast there, who was one of those friends that I kind of hated, but was my friend nonetheless. And she was dating one of my castmates on my cast. So it was a big, terrible upset. There was four people from the casts involved in this decision for us to break up. So there was, you know, there's what, 12 people in total. So four people left were having this big, really personal battle in the middle of trying to do shows and stuff. And I remember that you and Chet were like, well, there's no question about it. He's gone and you'll stay. And that was like, you know, nobody really had my back like that ever in my life outside of like my mom and stuff. So that was like a huge moment for me. And that was like another moment where I was like, well, then I've just got to do it better than anybody else. And I think to this day, the best show I've ever had was the show where that sheriff came downstairs and Tony Pasafume led him into the back, and he was like, where's Kyla Fitzgerald? And Tony was like, she's back there, you want to talk to her? And he sent a sheriff into the dressing room to serve me papers before we had like just gotten five, I think. And the sheriff was like, I talked to you for a second. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I bet you know what this is about. I'm like, well, I mean, I think I do. I live a dangerous life. It could be about anything. And he was like, I'm here to serve you papers. It comes with a restraining order. And I was like, wow, okay. Yep. Sounds good. And he was like, you're not mad? And I was like, no, I don't care. I was like, this is great. You know, good. I love it. I'm about to do a show. And I remember him being like, well, you know, I serve these papers to a lot of people every day. And you got to be one of the nicest people I've ever served papers to. And he was like, do you mind if I give you a hug? And I was like, no, please, feel free. And he gave me a hug. And I was like, do you want to stay and watch the show? And he was like, can I? And he did.
Unbelievable. And that's,
he stayed
and
that, yeah.
You know, that's a true story. And, you know, you were served. And certainly you're not making light of what was a very, very difficult situation in your life at the time. But, you know, the fact that you were then able to go out there after being served, after also convincing the person that served you these papers that he should stay for the show. And then you went out and you probably had one of the best shows of your life.
Oh, it was the best. And the very first suggestion that we got, it was Richie and I, and everybody on the cast kind of gave us space to let me just go out and do a scene with Richie. The very first suggestion we got was divorce. And I remember being like, this is great. I'm doing it now. And that's in my past. And I'll tell you, what followed was maybe 9 of the drunkest years I've ever had. But in like the best way possible. Like it was just like an absolute party. I feel like at that point in my life, I was like, everybody should get divorced so they can have this much fun.
Well, you know, and I will say from, you know, seeing you at, you know, a very personal low in terms of, you know, having to deal with these kind of things to seeing the person that you have, you know, blossomed into and the happiness that you have in your personal relationships now and everything like that, you know, it's been great to see. Kylie, I have to have you back as a part 2 because we're already like at an hour and we still have so many other things to cover. Your journey to Second City. I mean, Ireland itself could be an episode.
Oh my God. Oh God. We have to get the word out about those swindlers and what the hell was the name of that? Wait, what was the name of that? The Tivoli.
The Tivoli, yes.
The Tivoli swindlers.
The Tivoli swindlers and Tony. What was the name? Tony. Oh man. And there's just so much. We have to wrap it up. But I hope that you will come back for Kylie part 2, because anybody who is listening to this, this is just the beginning of Kylie's crazy goddamn journey in improv comedy.
It's all so far been the serious stuff. And after the divorce, I went nuts and we had the best time ever. So
that's our cliffhanger. Then that's what brings them back, Kylie. You got to leave them coming back and wondering what happens next. So will you come back?
Of course I will. Of course.
All right. Well, then we will set that up. But I do mean it, you know, from a talent standpoint, from a comedy standpoint. But then also from a personal standpoint, there's very few people that mean as much to me as you do. So thank you so much for all the, you know, all the talent and the love that you've given the Asylum and your time there and everybody there. And know that you always have a home. You always have a place to sleep in that crazy little bedroom up in the back by the office.
I love that space. And Norm, you're like a brother to me. You know, I hold you right up there with Jack. And I think you've always known that, though. Like, you and I can have, like, we can have an argument and disagree, but deep down, you know, it's like, well, it's like family. Doesn't matter if we fight.
Well, that's absolutely true. And so thank you. And everybody else, you got to stay tuned because Kylie's coming back, because we haven't even scratched the surface on Kylie's wild improv ride, and you're gonna be enthralled by the story she has to tell. So Kylie, thanks, and anything coming up, anything just kind of waiting for Second City to get rolling and all that kind of stuff? I mean, is that where you're at?
Yeah, we just got the word that it's another month here in Chicago of no nothing. So the only thing I got coming up is I'm probably gonna watch shows about Irish travelers tonight on YouTube until I pass out. So there you go.
Sounds to me like almost heaven. There you go. Yeah. All right. Well, that's Kylie Fitzgerald. Please kind of look her up on all of her social media stuff. She's the one and only. We love her. Ari Goldberg, our intrepid producer, thank you as always for keeping us on track and for fixing the shit that we can't fix.
Thanks, Ari.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate that. And I, Norman, as always, if you're looking for something to do to assist the people that bring you joy and happiness, those that make you laugh, smile, all that kind of stuff, all of those people that right now are not earning a living, you can always contribute to the No Rest for the Wicked Funny Foundation. We are taking contributions and distributing those funds out to out-of-work actors, comedians, employees, and people that work in our industry. And you can find that. There'll be a link on this, but it's no rest for the wicked funny .org. Thank you very much for listening to Beyond the Norm. I am Norm Lavalette. We will see you later.